The Task Management and Time Blocking Podcast, Episode 10. Have you ever wondered whether or not you're a time optimist? So you're someone who uses time blocking as a regular technique. You put tasks in your calendar so that you can make realistic commitments. But do you still run into the problem of time optimism, where you're allocating time, but things take far longer than you thought? This creates a ripple effect that affects everything you try to do. How do you even tackle a problem that afflicts almost everyone, even those who don't use a calendar at all? Tune into this episode to listen to me and my special guest, Trevor Lorbier, as we solve this challenging problem together. Welcome to the Task Management and Time Blocking Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Nosby, the fastest way to done. Nosby is an all-in-one tool for effective task and project management for individual users and teams. It organizes your work with simplicity so that you can focus on getting stuff done. Nosby is free for up to 5 active projects and 5 people in a team, so there's no excuse to wait. And the premium plan with unlimited projects starts with only $19 a month. Set it up in 3 easy steps and watch your projects move forward. So thanks to Nosby for sponsoring this episode of the Task Management and Time Blocking Podcast. And I'm going to tell you, I'm not just reading a promo spot. I've used Nosby. I actually used them for about a month. I'm still using them, but started about a month and a half ago to interact with the folks from the company as they were sponsoring the Task Management and Time Blocking Summit. And it's the best software I've ever used to communicate task and project information back and forth, mostly focused around the task that you need to do. Strongly recommend it. That's Nosby. Find out more, go to www.nosby.com. Welcome back. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see that I have special guest, Trevor Lorbier, who has joined us. I'm going to introduce Trevor in just a moment. And before I do that, let me just remind you, if this is your first time listening to this particular podcast, is that it's a little bit different from the others that kind of are kicking around out there. Why? Well, because we are looking to solve a problem, a challenge that people in the world of task management or time blocking frequently come across or have. So we spend the first time part of the episode actually defining the problem, kicking it around, looking at why it exists, what are some of the knock-on effects, why it's hard to solve, all the ramifications of the issue at hand. Then we switch gears and we go into solutions, the two of us. And it's a joint problem solving, a joint brainstorming session in which we're trying to find, believe it or not, something that neither of us knew before the conversation started, something brand new. And if that something brand new happens and comes about, you're going to hear this sound, a bell, which means that we found something. Yeah, it's like finding gold, right? So if we don't uncover anything, it's nothing bad, nothing wrong, but you'll hear a buzzer at the very end, which means that we had a great time, had a great conversation. You probably got something from it, and we didn't happen to come across anything brand new. Nothing wrong with that. So let's start off with a story. A month or so before the Smith project wraps up, your client gives you a call. Can you start working on the new King project right away, like next Monday? It's the fixed bid, so the dollars are already set, and we're going to be using a brand new technology that no one has ever used before. New stuff. You pause. This isn't your first rodeo. And this client accounts for more than half of your revenue. But in the back of your mind, you know that your current workload is just about full. You're about to say yes when you remember. The reason I'm not available, is that the Smith project is actually taking me 6 weeks longer than I thought. And I'm losing money on it as a result, like half my rate. So I'm working on the Smith project, basically half time for free and half time being paid. So you say to your client, can I sleep on it? And he says, sure, but listen, I need to know by tomorrow. Why? My back is against the wall. My boss, he's all over me and he needs an answer. And we have to get someone in to help us out. So the story sounds familiar. It may, because it's an everyday occurrence in which we get ourselves in all kinds of trouble because of time optimism. So let me introduce Trevor. He's the founder of Day Optimizer. It's a web app that helps freelancers and entrepreneurs create a daily plan that reflects their priorities using guided workflows designed around neuroscience principles. He also has created Strategic Life Tools, which is a membership site with tools for life planning and decision making, I think. He also has a blog that teaches people concepts and techniques to make better decisions. Trevor is he's a bi-continental person, yeah. Lives part of the time in North Carolina, the rest of the part time in Germany. So he's a swing dancer, he says. I guess he dances the swing in North Carolina, and he's working towards his B2 fluency when he's in Germany. Trevor, is that an accurate description of who you are and why you're here?
Yes, although I dance swing all over the world, and I also study my German wherever I am. So, yeah.
But is there a swing dancing in Germany? That's the kind of thing we want to know, you know?
Yes, there's a huge swing dancing community in Berlin. And in fact, last year I actually taught two classes at the university there. So,
in swing dancing?
Yes. Yeah, we have three levels of swing dancing that we teach at the university, me and my dance partner there.
I know nothing. Okay. That uniquely qualifies you to be to discuss this issue, although I can't figure out why. But here we go. So this problem of time optimism, Trevor, where have you seen it? This business of people making these estimates that are unrealistic and getting into trouble. Is that a problem that you've seen? I'm going to ask our guests, you know, you should really think about this as we're talking about it. So I invite you as a guest to think, ask yourself, where have I given estimates that were way too optimistic that got me into trouble? Or where have I been on the receiving end? Or where have I heard an over-optimistic estimate? And all I did was kind of smile and wave because I didn't want to confront the estimator. But Trevor, have you seen this problem?
Yes. I mean, I would say the problem exists in at least two different forms. The way you were just talking about it is the problem with explicit estimates, which is a problem of estimation, is I'm not good at estimating things. But there's also, I think, the problem of implicit estimates, which is when we look at our task list and think we can get way more done than we actually can. In that case, we're not necessarily actually estimating, doing any estimation on time. We just look at the list and have this kind of gut feeling like, yeah, I can get all that done. And aren't going through any sort of time estimation or allocation process. And that is also another problem with time optimists, where they don't even attempt to even figure out how much time something would take. They just look at it and go, yeah, I can get it done. But also, like you said, is once you go to the explicit part is when people then explicitly try to do estimates, they are also then bad at making those estimates as well. So both implicit and explicit time estimates and can lead to time optimism.
So we have two versions of the problem, the gut feeling version and the thinking person's version.
Yeah.
Now there is some research though that indicates, I think, thinking fast and slow, if I'm not mistaken, that talks about estimates. And I think one of the authors talks about some research that, or a book that they wanted to write, or conference they wanted to put on. Anyway, they thought it was going to take a year and it took 5 years. And These were all PhDs and very, very bright people, and they got the estimate completely wrong. And so there is a growing understanding that when we don't use past data, we make very poor estimates. But that apparently doesn't stop us, does it?
No, I mean, past data is only useful to the degree that it's applicable to the future. And as the financial prospectuses are always repeating, is past performance is no indication of future returns. So like what has happened in the past only works if there is a reason that is going to be strongly correlated with the future. And often it's not. The phrase, the devil's in the details, exists for a reason, is that those details often will throw off those correlations to where the past is no longer predictive of the future.
Right. So we have an especially difficult case, but at the same time, I imagine that there are those people who say that everything I'm doing is unique, that I can never use data. So I won't even bother to collect it. So that probably is one of the reasons why the problem persists, is that people don't even bother to collect the data in the first place, no?
Yes and no. I think there's categories of problems where you can collect the data and the data can be accurate. And there's categories of problems where even if you collect the data, it's not going to be accurate, right?
About the second one in particular.
Well, I think one of the distinctions that help you determine which category you're in is how often you've done the task before in the past, right? So like how often you yourself have done the task, or whoever's going to be doing the task before has done it in the past, mm-hmm. what the variance of that in the past has been, right? Mm-hmm. What is the potential for unknowns or uncertainties in the task? Mm-hmm. You know, and then what is does the task have a defined scope or not? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. as you move toward less defined scopes, more uncertainties, more variance, and increased newness, the person or less experience, the ability to predict how long that takes drastically reduces. Mm-hmm. And so we try to apply, I think, too often the lessons from areas where all those things are quite known. It's a clear mm-hmm. scope. I've mm-hmm. done it all the time, low variance, to mm-hmm. areas where that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Like
the case in the story. But another good example, so many construction projects go over budget, and you wonder, why do they go over budget when mm-hmm. these firms have been doing construction all the time? Well, if you're building a template house, and you know, you've got the same blueprint, and say you're building like Levittown or some sort of like community where every house is exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Then you should get pretty accurate after the third or fourth house on how mm-hmm. long it takes to build the house. It's mm-hmm. the same house, there's not too many details. You know, yeah, the lumber might differ a little bit, but you're going to have a very tight variance. It's a tight scope. You know when the house is done, mm-hmm. right? There's mm-hmm. shouldn't be too many unknowns. Mm-hmm. And you're using the same construction team. So you actually get like more efficient over time. So your estimates mm-hmm. actually, you probably come in under budget, hopefully, as you improve. However, if you are the same builder and what you're doing is you're building completely different houses and clients are coming to you with the blueprints of a house that they had an architect do. And mm-hmm. there's different architects now, there's different clients who have different needs. So everything is completely new every single time. Well, yeah, certain things are going to be the same, like maybe the way you lay the foundation, or the way you put lumber together is the same. But there's so many unknowns in that maybe weren't all considered. Now, if you had like, for instance, a good architect, maybe they've thought through a lot of those unknowns and you'll have less variance. But maybe if that architect hadn't really isn't good at translating their stuff into the buildings, or they don't know the problems that crop when you're building up, then maybe you don't have that. So there you can have a lot of different variants. And I think that's what happens. Again, like I'm using the building example because it happens all over the place where people projects come in over budget for buildings, but it happens in IT projects, it happens in personal projects all over the place. Even people who are super professional at estimating can run into these issues because they are applying the lessons from those narrowly defined projects to these wild unknown projects.
And these are the better cases, because the folks we're talking about here in this moment are the ones who know that they need to be doing estimating. So the chances are they have some kind of data. They have some notion of the discipline they need to be following. They have some statistical understanding of variance and other factors. So this wouldn't be news to them, in other words, if you were to explain it to them. People who are, people who are trained in construction to any degree know these things because they've learned them. And they can also tell you horror stories of when, prior projects they were on that went really, really badly. But it is the bigger challenge that even the people who are trained, there's something stronger than their training, like almost like an instinct. The planning fallacy is the psychological bias that we have to assume the best will happen when life never cooperates and evidence shows, and when we collect data, it shows, and we all know from something's going to go wrong, it will, Murphy's Law, we have all these anecdotes. But in the heat of the moment, for example, in the story, in the heat of that moment, something overrides our more rational judgment. And we fall into the planning fallacy, and we create a mess of it. Is it just something in human? Is it something in human nature that we can't overcome, or that anyone can overcome? Because I wonder if they have these stories that, planners meetings always start late because half of them arrive at the meeting late because they thought there wouldn't be any traffic. I wonder if that's what happens in real life. They know these things in theory, and in the right structured environment and with the right construction project manager, they would actually follow them. But as soon as there's an opportunity to not follow them, they don't follow them. So half of them arrive late at the meeting and say, traffic, you wouldn't believe what happened out there.
Yeah.
Is there something so strong inside of us that there's just no way? Should we just end the podcast because there's no solution?
I would say that there's variance in how, I'm not a project management professional, so I can't speak to how well they do that in their personal lives either. There's certainly disciplines project management is a discipline that helps you learn how to do some of these things better, right? Learn how to plan better. And for those people, they can ignore some of that advice. Like you said, in their personal lives, they might ignore some of that advice. There's things that they can do to get better from a project management perspective is defining the scope a little bit more upfront, to manage their risk curve, right? So a classic thing, and especially if you're doing, again, projects that have large unknowns, is you try to tackle the largest unknowns first. One of the common mistakes that I would say a lot of that people make is that they do the easy stuff first that are known so they can get it out of the way to make sure that they have room for the later stuff, when instead what they should be doing, they should be doing the things that seem impossible at the beginning or that have large unknowns, solve those first and leave all the easy stuff for the end.
Another psychological bias, right?
Well, that helps you manage, because then what happens is if you start with your unknowns at the beginning, then even if you wind up going over your time or over your budget, as you get closer to your launch date or your final date where everything's supposed to be done, you have less and less uncertainty there. And so you're more accurate being able to tell the client or whoever, your boss, say, yes, we are going to be able to do it by this date. Whereas if what you do is you leave the unknowns toward the end,
you're dead.
That's where you run into the classic problem of the first 90% of the project the second 10% of the project took the other 90% of the time. That's a classic, that whole saying comes from the idea of leaving all your unknowns to the end. Now, it's not always possible to leave your unknown, do all your unknowns in the beginning, because you may not know them. It might be the classic unknown unknowns. Right. They can also be pressure from your boss or your client to say, hey, I need you to be showing me progress, or I need to be doing this X, Y, and Z. And that's where the other problem where you spoke about optimism bias, which is, you know, we often think things do go better than they actually do, right, as humans. And one of the factors that plays into that is the social dynamics with the person placing demands onto us.
Right,
is like, when
like the story had.
Yeah, when someone places those demands onto us and says, like, I need you to do this quickly, there is pressure to reduce your estimations, even if you know it's going to take that amount of time. And on the other side is they are ironically often more accepting to, okay, we have a delay, we ran into problems, we need to extend it, than they are with the original upfront estimate. Mm-hmm. So if you tell someone that it's going to take them 3 years to build your house, mm-hmm. and because you know all the unknowns and you've worked out the accurate estimate, it's three years, mm-hmm. they're probably going to go with the person who tells them it's only going to take 1 year,
yeah.
and then winds up taking them 4 years, right?
Yep.
Just because of the way the psychology works. Right. I mean, we're more accepting to say, okay, well, the sunk cost fallacy. Oh, I've got the sunk cost. We're just going to go with this. And sunk costs can be real things. Like if I'm starting to build a house, I'm not going to just abandon the house. Like there's some real issues around some of that. So yeah, I think there's lots of pressures that cause us to try to underestimate. But then there's also
personality. In for a pwn kind of thinking that.
Yeah.
If as long as I start, then the chances of me being the one to finish it are increased if I start. So let me start.
Yeah. Yeah. People tend to,
they want to hear so that at least I start.
Yeah. Or, and there is, that creates this bias that we don't think it's, there's not an incentive to think critically about our time. Right. Yeah. Because if I thought critically about my time and told my client the actual, like more accurate estimate, they may not hire me. So, and if I do that and then lowball my estimate, I'm essentially lying to my client,
right?
Which I'm not going to feel good about. But if I don't actually do that estimate that detailed, and I just, you know, like rule of thumb it,
I'm not lying.
And then if something, it turns out to be longer, okay. You know,
but at least you're being somewhat true to yourself. By being reckless and loose and slack this makes me think that as far as the disciplines have progressed, and of course there's been lots of progress in how we think about estimates compared to where we were 50 years ago. In spite of it, the psychological and social pressures are ever present, and I suspect that even the most disciplined, the most trained person, you know, when his or her spouse or his or her children look to them with a certain look, I wonder if all that training goes out the window because of psychological and social pressure. When it kicks in, it doesn't just change things by 5%; it changes them by 90%.
Yeah,
it doesn't strike me as it's a moderating influence. This is kind of an all or nothing. You're either in your sane mind making a logical professional estimate, or that's all out the window and you're telling people what they want to hear or what gets you out of trouble or the shortest path to the money or all of these other psychologically appropriate reasons. It's going to be interesting when we get to the solutions, but this at least explains why we keep making the same error, even though we have more information. I mean, I'm guilty of this. I've been collecting data on my time usage for 20 years, maybe more.
Yeah.
And I have it all backed up. Do I actually use it explicitly to make estimates? Really, I don't go back to, that's an organization problem. Is that to go and track the numbers back would take me so long that when someone calls me and asks me for an estimate by tomorrow, I can't go back and research 20 years of yada, yada, yada and figure out which project got which time and it. So I don't do it. I this could just be reality, but I just don't have the time to go do all of that. I use my hunch. I use a hunch.
Yeah.
It's informed by some data I have somewhere, but do I go back and look at the data and analyze it before putting my hunch into words? No.
And I would say that, again, like, it depends upon what category of project or thing that you're doing on whether it's valuable to do that or not. Like, if you are doing...
You're right, but keep going.
I mean, if you were doing the same type of project over and over again, then it is worth tracking that data, analyzing that data, and then coming up with some rules of thumb based upon your analysis on doing forward-based estimations. But like, again, if you were like, there's some people who specialize, for instance, in 5-page website designs, right?
Okay.
Right. 5 pages, I know exactly, it's a very fixed amount of thing. Or anyone who's doing piecework on producing, manufacturing anything. If I make shoes, I make dresses, whatever. It's like, you know, I should be able to get to the point where I know per piece how long it takes me. And then if someone says, you know, I need you to make 100 pieces, you can give me a good estimate, right? Same thing with like website design or what is, with certain cases of that.
I have an example of a case where I have my estimation is accurate in spite of what I just said. I put out a weekly column for a newspaper.
Yes.
And it's due on Thursdays every 2 weeks. And I have the process for doing so dialed in at this point. And as you said, it's repeatable. I collect the ideas randomly through, you know, weeks before and have them stored in a safe place. I go to the list on either Sunday or Monday morning. I pick the topic. I do the first draft by Monday morning. I second draft it, third draft it, fourth draft it, send it to my wife for the ultimate approval. She sends me back any corrections or anything that doesn't make any sense. I do a final. And so like I said, this is 10 years of doing this without a break anywhere. I haven't skipped a deadline. I haven't missed a deadline yet, but this is 10 times. Yeah. How many times I've done this, 10 years times, how many times? Oh, that's a lot of articles. When I think about that, should have come up with something good by now, right? But it is dialed in. But the fortunate thing is that I now have it to the point where I have, maybe this is part of the where we could look for solutions. So let's flip from the problem and into the solutions for the second part of our time together.
Before we do that, let me break out like two different more? Problems. What well, problem? I want to break out the two different problems that this person is facing here. Sure. And to tie back into what I said before about implicit and explicit time optimism. So this person has two different issues here. One is they're being asked about, can you fit this new project into your schedule, right? And it's a fixed bid project, so I need to figure out, do I want to take this on or not? Like, come sort of like my estimate, it may not be accurate about it. So there's some sort of estimation component into this. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is my workload is full, right? This client is only half my workload. So now I also have this implicit time optimism too, is how long does everything else in my day take? And, you know, how much time am I going to be able to spend on my other client work? You know, and are those clients going to get angry? How much time am I going to be spending on other things? Like, I'm going to want to hang out with my spouse perhaps, or maybe I want to, you know, maintain my exercise routine. Mm-hmm. And then in a typical, if you have a client-based business, well, I have this client here who's giving me 50% of my business, so that's great. But you also often want to constantly be going out and sourcing new business so you don't go through feast and famine cycles. A very typical mm-hmm. problem in a consultancy is mm-hmm. someone gets a bunch of client work and then they just work on the client work and they mm-hmm. completely forget about trying to get new business into the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And once all that client work is done, suddenly they have no work and then mm-hmm. they're in a famine cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the compounding in there is they sometimes aren't billing when they're doing the work because they're so focused on the work, they forget to bill and mm-hmm. then they get paid too late. So, mm-hmm. So this problem, this person has both an estimation problem. How do I estimate this task? Mm-hmm. But they also have an allocation problem. How am I going to allocate my time across my, my other clients, my personal work, mm-hmm. and then the other work I need to do for my business, my admin work and my marketing work, my sales and marketing work.
But don't we bring some optimism to the allocation as well?
They absolutely do. They're going to.
I can make magic happen and get 175 into 168.
Exactly. So you have time optimism happening on both halves, on both the allocation side and on the estimation side. So I just wanted to introduce that from the problem before we go to the solution, because we might need to address both. It's two different approaches for
addressing both. It's two different kinds of problems. And I think that in the moment, we could easily commit both. When under pressure, when under social and psychological pressure, we can commit both of them. And there's a kind of a fooling ourselves that goes on, and we're willingly fooling ourselves because we want to believe that magic can happen. We want to believe that this is the unicorn project where all of our productivity techniques will come to bear and we will be amazingly productive, unlike any other time in our lives ever before. We tell ourselves these things in the moment. Oh yeah, when I can. And then all of a sudden, this hopeful optimism kicks in and starts to ruin both sides of the equation.
Yeah. Well, and I would add the other thing that happens there too is, even if you're an experienced project manager who is really good at estimating time for fixed scope projects, some of the things I just described in the allocation category are open scope. And open scope, the strategies you apply toward open scope activities, I wouldn't call them projects because there's no end necessarily, mm-hmm. Are different than those you apply to fixed scope projects. And so even if you're really good as a project manager on fixed scope, you still may be suffering from time optimism on your open scope stuff.
Right. Because, you know, again, that sounds psychological to me because this is like my vacation. I don't need to give a real estimate. So
yeah,
I throw everything to the wind. You know, this is like time off. Like, oh okay, sure. I'll let you know at some point when we figured out when it's going to be, you know, is that Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel. When will it be finished? Oh, when it's finished.
Yeah.
Not a moment before. Because operating under a fixed contract is stressful. So, or a fixed bid or a fixed situation, but not having that constraint can feel like, oh, I can relax.
Yeah.
And at that point, what the heck?
Yeah, exactly.
Just as long as you keep the person in the loop. Okay. All right. So, This is a knotty problem. If it were only a technical problem, we'd be finished ages ago, and we'd apply an equation that would solve for X, and this would be all done, and we'd all be all happy. But it seems as if we could talk about discipline all we want, because that's probably what, you know, that's the first thing you think of, is that you just need to be disciplined, so that when those moments come, you stick to your guns. But I don't think discipline is the right kind of solution. The pressure is too great in that moment. What do you think?
I tend to think that, in general, discipline and willpower are not the things you necessarily want to rely on. Like mm-hmm. there's the general idea that with habits, you want to rely on your environment. With you know, using default rules can be really powerful mm-hmm. on stuff. Mm-hmm. While sometimes it's useful to bring discipline and willpower to the problem, mm-hmm. it's better to have fallbacks. So for instance, there's the checklist manifesto, which is saying, let me have a checklist of all the things I need to do for any procedure to make sure that I am doing the procedure correctly, right? One could say is, well, why don't you just have the discipline to like do that, or you memorize it or whatnot? Now I still have that discipline. I just have to have the discipline to then use the checklist. So I reduce the amount of discipline I use. So in cases like this where I need to make a decision, having a decision framework, having an estimation framework that I can rely on, I still have to have the discipline to use those frameworks, but then I can rely on the discipline, I can rely on those frameworks to then as my backstop. So if I go through an estimation framework and I say, hey, this is going to take 500 hours, you know, or 300 hours or whatnot to my client, and my client goes, that much? Like, I thought it was going to take only 50 hours. And you can go, well, you know, no, I've done the analysis, right? So it creates this way to support you being disciplined in holding your ground, creating your boundaries, that sort of things.
Okay. So in essence, following your checklist for doing estimates helps you win the psychological and social battle when your client or the other person to whom you're giving the estimate queries it.
Correct. Yeah.
If you, so if you followed your process and you trust it, you at least have some possible extra conviction. So following the checklist added to your conviction.
Yes, it adds to your conviction.
I'm going to ring our bell. Following our process or predefined process builds conviction.
Yeah, and creating structures. Creating structures, like you talked about before, being late to a meeting because you didn't account for traffic, right? And the other thing that we don't account for is the amount of time from when we decide to leave the house to when we're actually driving away in the car or, you know, getting on the subway, and the amount of time then it takes to get from there to actually sitting in that room for the meeting, right? Parking the car or whatever. And I call that, I have this framework called the prep, do, wrap framework. And the idea is you always have prep time and wrap time for any activity, and we don't consider that. Well, if, yeah, so if instead what you do is you go, okay, every activity is going to have the prep, do, wrap phase. I have this framework, and I can apply that and go, okay, it's going to take me 15 minutes to drive there. Well, now I also need to apply the, all I have to do is apply the framework, and the framework already then says, well, then how much time are you prepping for? How much time is wrapping? So then I go, okay, 15 minutes to drive there. It's going to take me about 5 minutes to get out of the house, 5 minutes to park and get in the building. So now I'm at 25 minutes. So that might be one framework. And now I might still have to account for traffic. And so then maybe my framework for that is to every time before I leave the house, check Google, and then add 10 minutes to what Google says, right?
And the best part, add 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And so now we've developed a process by which we can ensure that we're at meetings on time.
And this is not just for meetings, obviously, but
absolutely not. Yeah.
Do you recommend that you apply it to high stakes appointments like meetings first before the others?
I mean, I apply it to almost every meeting I have. Is I have, like, whether I'm driving or not, like, I always have a prep, do, wrap phase. I think that's critical for almost everything we do. It's useful to come into a meeting prepared, and it's useful after the meeting to take notes, figure out what your next action items are, maybe immediately do your follow-ups directly from the meeting, but there's almost always some wrap-up after the meeting as well. Doing it for conferences. A lot of people, they'll book a conference on their calendar, but they won't book the time before the conference to prepare for the conference to see who they want might want to meet, what are going to be the key things. They're not allocating enough time for that. And they don't book enough time afterwards for follow-up, for networking, for taking their notes and reviewing the notes. Knowledge that you gain from a conference and connections that you make from a conference are only valuable if you then follow up on that, if you review that knowledge, if you reach out to those people afterwards and you work to build those relationships. So recognizing that everything has this prep phase and a wrap phase, and then allocating time for it helps you in the grander scheme be less of a time optimist when you're going to meetings, going to conferences, all that sort of thing.
I doubt that anyone listening would argue with prep do wrap. I think the problem is the regular and routine application of it, to because you could apply it to every single task.
Yeah.
But I imagine that you're saying prep do wrap is particularly valuable in cases like meetings or unknown tasks where there's a higher degree of variability.
It's more useful
than even.
I would say, so I haven't thought about when it would be useful, but let me try to riff on when it potentially might be useful. Mm-hmm. I would say it is useful in situations where the activity you do or doing has future implications. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on one is your preparation going into the activity has affects the performance of the activity itself. And then your ability to review or in some way wrap up that has implications for the future. Mm-hmm. So if you are doing something that is an isolated task that, like for instance, you don't have to prep and wrap to empty the dishwasher, right? You empty the dishwasher, when the dishwasher is empty, it's done.
That does depend on your home situation, but I get the point.
Potentially, yeah. But like in general, you don't have to prep and wrap to empty the dishwasher. If the tasks are going to be completed in the time you're doing it, and then once the task is done, there's no reason to review it anymore, then, you know, like filing your taxes could kind of fall into that. You might want to do some prep work for your taxes, but like once you file your taxes, you know, you file them in that drawer and, you know, there's probably little wrap up. You don't need to go review it like, you know, and a week later and, oh, did I do my taxes right? Or whatever. However, say you're doing a project and you're working on a project, say you're writing a book and you're writing a chapter and what your idea is to write 1,000 words a day. It can be helpful to have a prep and a wrap phase in there. In the prep phase, what you're doing is you are loading what you did in previous days into your brain and figuring out what you want to spend your time on. Then you start writing. And in the wrap phase, what you want to do is you want to record where you are in that process. Get down all your thoughts about what to do the next day. So that way, what you're doing is you're linking each of those together. Each time you sit down to write, you're linking it, you're taking it from the link from the past and then linking it to the future at the end. And so that prep, do, wrap phase creates this link that helps you build momentum through that. Whereas say yesterday you didn't do any wrap, like you were writing and then there was an emergency, you had to just drop everything, right?
Right.
When you come in the next day, it's gonna take you a lot longer to get started because you don't know where you're at. You didn't take any notes, you didn't write down anything, it just stopped. And so now you need to like go back, figure out where you're at, start building momentum. And so your efficiency that day and your momentum that day is a lot lower than if you have a prep and a wrap phase.
So it sounds like it's the future is about dependency.
Yes. Yeah. You could say it's about dependencies. If there's a dependency, if what I'm doing has a dependency on the future, then I should try to have a wrap phase on that.
Because of that ripple effect that I mentioned at the very beginning, that if you get the first part wrong and don't correct it, you'll get the second part wrong, third part wrong, and then it'll all be downhill from there.
Yeah, well, there's two things. There's ripple effects and then there's momentum. So you can think of it as speed and direction. If your direction is off even by a few degrees, say you're boating and your direction's off by a few degrees, you know, a little bit later, you're only a little bit apart. But if you let that keep going, you just drift farther and farther apart. So even small variances in how off alignment you are can cause huge variances over time. And then the second thing is the speed component, which I mentioned, which is like, you know, are you starting, stopping, or are you moving at a constant speed or even accelerating because you're building on what you're doing each day? So those are like two different ways to think about it, but both of them are relate to how do I move from this spot to this spot somewhere in ahead of me.
Just to where we started along this thread. Prep, do, wrap helps you deal with dependent sequences of tasks, or in other words, processes that extend into the future. And if you don't do your prep, do, wrap, be prepared to pay for it in terms of speed and momentum.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's a bell. Yeah. All right. That's the one. That's one. Okay. The second one I asked was, how about the variability? Do you do prep, do, wrap when you get that this is a novel kind of situation? You have limited data to go with. You have very little experience. Do you spend more time prepping and more time wrapping up? And do you build that time in? I don't. I like to rush off to the next thing as soon as something is even, if it smells like it's finished.
Yeah.
I have that whatever profile that is in Myers-Briggs. I'm a J, and once things start to smell finished, I'm on to the next one. I'm thinking of what I'm doing next. I'm done. I'm already done. My mind are already gone. I might be even here, if it's not, my mind is gone.
Even if it's not actually done.
Yeah, especially when it's actually gone. That's the finishing it up is like the boring part, and wrapping up is like, kill me first. I'd rather go seek the thrill of the next thing rather than wrap anything up.
You're like a novelty seeker.
Default way of, yes.
Yeah.
Confession.
Yeah.
So prep to wrap would be particularly important for me in those cases where I'm about to tackle a project where I don't know how long it's going to take, is what I'm gathering.
Yes. Well, so, and so this goes back into the project management side. And let's go in and talk real briefly about the two different things that I talked about, open scope versus fixed scope. So like, okay. Mm-hmm. If I have a project and I'm doing fixed scope, I believe it does. And again, qualification is I'm not a professional project manager. So they have a whole bunch of tools at their tool set that are much more effective than I'm going to be able to present. But in my conception is that what you want to do in the beginning is try to identify your potential unknowns as much as possible, or at least the areas where those unknowns may hide. So you want to avoid, you know, opening a box and it being a can of worms, and now suddenly you're deep within this issue. Mm-hmm. That's not always possible, but to the degree that you can think that through, that is useful. I am a big fan of explicitly.
Because I think there's an intuitive way to do what you said. The problem is that you may not do all of it. You may not remember sometimes. You may decide this time I'm gonna wing it. For various reasons, you might want to skip that.
Well, and I think it's also important, particularly for unknowns, to write down everything that you think you know, and then take a step back and come back to it and say, what are the gaps? Or there's another example. What is it? I'm going to forget his name. Is it Fenneman or a method for learning things and to really know that you know it? Is to write down everything you know about a topic and then try to explain it to someone who knows nothing about that topic, or try to explain it to like a 6-year-old, right?
Heard of that, yeah.
And then every time someone asks you a question you can't answer, write that down, then go research those answers, try again. And until you can have a very simplified example that you can teach to someone, you haven't truly learned it. But you can use a similar process for project planning, is where you write down everything you think you know about the project, right? And how you think it's going to play out. And then you go and you explain that to someone else. And then they're going to ask you, like, particularly like another project manager, someone who has that mentality, ask you questions, and then they're going to uncover unknowns that you didn't think about. Or there's the pre-mortem strategy, right? Which is where I go 6 months in the future or whatever and say, the project failed, why did it fail? And then you work backwards to find out why it failed, and then that uncovers unknowns. So there's lots of different strategies for uncovering those unknowns, but taking the time to uncover those unknowns, especially for important projects. For unimportant projects, not so much, but for important projects, taking the time up front to uncover where the unknowns might be is really useful, because that lets you then start figuring out how to even approach estimating time.
It triggers your decision to use prep do wrap, because I won't do prep do wrap for when I'm brushing my teeth, because there's some dependency on, you know, going to the dentist, but there's not immediate dependency, and also there's a whole lot of unknowns. I can't think of an unknown that happens when I brush my teeth. So in that case, it wouldn't trigger the use of prep do wrap. But in the opposite extreme, where either of those two are present and the number of unknowns is high. Well, how do you know the number of unknowns is high before you actually make that list? Because you can't make a list for everything and say, okay, I'm going to comb my hair. How many are the unknowns and combing my hair? You know, you'll die by paralysis if you try to apply this to everything.
One shortcut. This isn't like totally accurate, but my way of looking at. Let me take a step back. So I believe effective project management more effective when you use multi-point estimates instead of single point estimates. And what I mean by that is that what most people do is they say this subtask of my project is going to take 2 hours or 4 hours. They give it a single estimate, right? It is better, in my opinion, to say best case, worst case. You could even do what's called three-point
distribution,
which is best coins. Worst case, expected case, right?
Normal curve. If you get
there's a great project management software called Liquid Planner that actually lets you have a whole series of tasks with dependencies, all with multi-point estimates, and then will tell you this is your 95% probable finish date, is your 98%, 99% probable finish dates based upon combining all those probabilities.
We need some of those on a daily basis, like at our fingertips.
Yeah, but then the question becomes is how do you figure out like what your best case, worst case should be, right? And what I am a big fan of is creating categories of tasks that tell you in general how risky those tasks are. So I just pulled up an old article I wrote about this. Uh-huh. And here in this case, I have 7 different categories that I would classify a task under. So going and starting at the least risky is routine tasks. Things I do regularly, they have fixed endpoint, few unknowns, low variance. Sure, yeah, exercise, taking a shower, all those things. Then we have chores, which are just a one-off task. They usually have a fixed endpoint, few unknowns, low to medium variance. So the example there is buying a new shirt or calling to cancel a service. Probably not going to have too much variance. Okay. Then you have remixing, where I take an existing creation and I reconfigure it. So like editing a document, improving a business practice, updating a marketing campaign, right?
The scope is the same, but the contents are reordered in some way.
Yeah, reorganized. The scope may not be completely fixed because I may not know exactly when I'm done. Maybe I'm going to have a gut feel for when I'm done. Okay. So maybe I time box that a little bit and say I'm only going to spend an hour editing this document. So I can create a time-based scope if I want to. Okay. But they tend to have low to medium variance unless you get into this perfectionist spiral. Some people get into a perfectionist spiral where they then just keep going down the rabbit hole of spending hours and hours trying to get something absolutely perfect, there's a whole nother strategy for that. But then that can create variance. But in general, remixing tend not to have a variance. Research things, this is where I'm trying to gather information about a topic. Often that has no fixed endpoint. And the problem is that new avenues are going to open up and that bring you down unexpected paths. So it tends to have a lot of variance. It's like, if you're going to research a new stereo or whatever, like research which software you need to buy for your business, you're going to do some initial research and then maybe a new option pops up that causes you to reevaluate everything. So there's ways to look at it is like point of no returns. Am I hitting a point where like new information isn't actually causing me to change my decision in any way? The strategies around that, but it's going to from a, before you actually go into a research thing and you're trying to estimate it, you need to realize that is going to have medium to high variance. You might think it's going to take an hour, but it could easily take 5-10 hours to research. So there's a lot of variance. Implementation, that's where you have a plan already made and you need to make it happen. Right. So that it's going to have a fixed endpoint. But there's often some surprises along the way. Again, if you got the blueprints for the house, but when the lumber comes, maybe the lumber's warped and you have to deal with that. Right. So there's going to be some medium variance there. Okay. We've got creation, where I'm developing something new, but it's similar to something someone else has done in the past. So,
it's a bit of a mimicry.
Yeah. Like I'm going to write a book. Okay. People have written books in the past. I can read advice on how to write a book, you know, or I'm going to build a software product, whatever. The specifics might be different, but the general process has been the same. But that's going to have medium to high variance. And then the one that has extremely high variance is invention. And that's where I'm going to create something new that no one has ever done before, right? Like I'm going to cure cancer or I'm going to like whatever, right? I'm going to do something that no one has ever done before. There's no roadmap for that. There's no endpoint for that. There's, or there might be an endpoint, but there's like the way you approach that kind of task is completely different than the others because there's so many unknowns and because there's so high variance. So what I do is I first say like, what type of task? And people can come up with their own categories, but having categories of like, what type of task is this? This then tells me the variance. And there's the old standard project manager multiplier is you take whatever time estimate someone gives you and multiply it by 3. And that's what I give to my client, right? and like, that's a good rough rule of thumb, right? But I think it is also useful to look at and say, if you want to get more specific, is to say, have different rules of thumbs for each of these categories. So again, for routine tasks, I might just multiply it by 1. But once I get into like remixing where I'm editing something, okay, maybe I multiply by that 2. There might be some problems, but there tends not to be, you know, whatever. When I get into like a creation
or
I'm going to multiply that by invention. 5, and maybe invention, I'll multiply by 10 or 20, right? So I'm going to not just apply a blanket rule of thumb. I'm going to look at what type of tasks this project involves, and then using different rules of thumb for those different types. Going back to our example at the very beginning, where like part of the setup for this episode is that a client is coming and asks us to work on a new project with a new technology no one's ever done before. Okay, I need to use a higher multiplier for that than if someone is coming and asks me to do a project that I do all the time. Different types of multipliers for different types of projects. So there is no blanket rule, but like having just some sort of sense of that. And then where you can use that multiplier is, what I do with that multiplier, someone tells me 2 hours and my multiplier is 4. I can say, okay, it's going to be from 2, say I have a multiplier of, say a multiplier of 5. So they give me an estimate of 2, it's 2 to 10 hours. So I use whatever they give me as the worst case. But you could also say like, okay, like, well, they give me an estimate of 2 and my multiplier is 5, say my multiplier is 4, 2 to 8 hours. So I could say it's going to be anywhere from a half an hour to 8 hours, however you kind of want to do it. So I could divide, I could take the point estimate and say the estimate they give me is the middle one, and then use my multiplier to calculate each end.
Both sides, right?
Or what I do, because it's simpler, is to say, the estimate they gave me is the worst case, and I multiplied it at the best case.
So you start with their estimate.
Yes.
Could get you with all kinds of trouble.
Well, you have to start somewhere, right? You have to start somewhere.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, it strikes me, and by the way, we'll have to wrap up at this point because we're just about at the end of the hour. Is your investment in coming up with these multipliers has made all the difference. When someone approaches you, you've invested the time to say, this is important for me. And the chances of you forgetting that you came up with these multipliers because of social and psychological pressure is far lesser or far lower.
Yes.
Because you're the actual one who puts it in place. So if I had my druthers, I guess I would put everyone through a multiplier development, multiplier by category development workshop.
Yeah.
And have it be your preparation for when someone comes to you and they put you in the heat of the moment. And there you have to pick one time, three times, five times, or 10 times. And in the flash of a moment, you say, this sounds like a three. And you give an answer. So at least you have it's almost like a pre-rehearsed heuristic.
It helps you to at least pause and think, because now you can start thinking in terms of these categories. So you can say, is this something that requires invention, creation, remixing, or is it something I do all the time? Right. And just being able to like kind of look at that, or saying like, what percentage of this project is invention? What percentage of the project, even if you're not going down to the individual task level, someone gives you a project and what's my gut feel for how much is invention, how much is creation, how much is remixing? Right. And then I can use that to kind of just gut feel my stuff. But now I'm at least recognizing the characteristics that make one project different from another project that might mean my task estimations, or again, at the beginning of the episode, we said, the past does not always predict the future. So why does it not? And one of the reasons it does not is because the mix of these different types of tasks from project to project is different. And so my number of unknowns is different.
I really like this. It gives you a practical step to do, to perform right in that moment. And you can be very clear about the cost if you decide not to do it. And it's something you could practice doing, because in a workshop setting, you could throw people different projects, theoretical projects, and say, all right, what's your blend for this project? What's your blend for that project? What's your blend for this one? You're under pressure. Yeah. Here's a role play. What's your answer? And actually start to give the person some practice. And so when the time comes and they're actually on the court and the ball is being served to them, metaphorical ball is being served to them, they don't just freeze.
Yeah.
They go back to Trevor's advice. Speaking of advice, Trevor, where can people get more of your insights and wisdom and spend some time with you?
Yeah, so people can find me at dayoptimizer.com, which is a time management web app for solopreneurs to help them better plan their day. And that is a lot more focused on the part of the episode we didn't talk in this episode, which is how do I allocate my time and take the amount of time in my day and figure out how much time I'm going to spend on my multiple competing priorities.
I think that's our next call.
Yeah, that's a whole separate episode.
Right. We did estimation in this one and we'll do allocation in the next one.
Exactly. So yeah, that's the best place for them to find me. I also have a website called Strategic Life Tools where people can find, it's now free. You're just free to join and you get different tools for building life plans. And then again, Lean Decisions, where I'm applying the same sort of stuff that we talked today about creating different categories of decisions so you know which type of decision you're making so you can figure out what is the best way to make that type of decision.
Great, fantastic. Trevor Lorbier, thanks for joining me here on the Task Management and Time Blocking Podcast. It sounds like we've already booked the time for you to come back. So until we hear from you later.
Yes, thank you so much.
Great. So guys, keep listening. There's a little bit more coming up after the music that's coming up and we'll wrap up this episode and keep listening. Before we go on, let me tell you about another one of our sponsors, Predict. So Predict is a software that allows you to schedule your days to maximize flow and performance, not attendance. Because there's no point in working when your brain and your body are just not ready. Having 2 or 3 hours of profoundly focused work produces 30% better results than 10 hours of unfocused effort. And Predict is here to help you find those 90-minute blocks in your day based on what your body and your routines tell you to do. That's Predict, PRDIKT.co. Here's a clip from our next episode. So you're someone who loves to focus on what is important in each moment. In fact, there may be few things more cherished than being in the flow state when you're getting your best work done. As it's happening, time flies by, and sometimes you even feel euphoric, proud of what you're accomplishing. But too much of a good thing is never good. And if you have ever missed a midday meal because you're engrossed in your work, you may know that sometimes you need a reminder or an interruption at just the right moment. They're helpful, they keep you on track, and they prevent you from making mistakes. But how do you program these interruptions or reminders into your life? In this solo episode, I'll be sharing my thinking about this particular problem and what needs to be invented for us to get some permanent relief. And if you want to leave a comment about this episode or any aspect of the work that we're doing here at the Task Management and Time Blocking Podcast, you can go over to www.replytofrancis.info and send me either a message by text or send me a voice message, a voice note. And as you probably know, we have a couple of places that you can interact with other people, talk about this episode. One is at the community, mightytaskers.scheduleu.org, and you'll see the link in the show notes. And the other, of course, is our upcoming Task Management and Time Blocking Summit coming up in March. Two outstanding opportunities to interact with other people about the ideas that you've heard on this podcast or any of your episodes that are coming up. And if you'd like to support the work we're doing, I invite you to click on the Patreon link below to make a donation. And please don't forget to like our show and recommend it to others on iTunes, Stitcher, Google, or whatever podcast app or service you're using. This is Francis Wade. I'm signing out. I hope to see you on a future episode. And until then, take care and all the best. See you later.